hope you're having a good week. I've been out, if you've emailed me or called me or anything this week, I kind of got to the emails really quick just tonight right before church and typed out some quick responses. I haven't even listened to my phone messages, so I'm not shining you on. I've been out at the pastor's conference all week, actually running back and forth. I'll be out there again tomorrow. So if you need me desperately, usually my cell phone's off when I was out there because I was doing a lot of things on camera and stuff. So, but you know, somebody else in the office will be glad to help you, and I'll be back in. I should be in the office on Friday, I would think. So if you need anything, I've been gone all week. So apologize if I've missed you and you've been trying to get a hold of me. Now let's turn in our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 29. It's a big night because we're finishing up the book of 1 Samuel tonight, Lord willing. And I don't get too sidetracked. It's only three chapters left. One of them's really short. So that's a big step because now we're going to see at the end of 1 Samuel, David has been in hassles with Saul. Although David was anointed to be the king over Israel, God hadn't taken him yet where he was going to take him. Israel would have been better off with David as their king, but God knew that in order to really make him the king that God wanted him to be, he needed a few more encounters with Saul and with others. And often we become impatient in our lives because we think we know what God's trying to do, and we just wish he'd get on with it. Just do what it is that he wants to do. We sometimes feel, God, you've prepared me for something. I know that you've anointed me for some particular ministry, or perhaps I'm ready to be married, or you know, I'm ready to get out on my own, or I'm ready to pursue this career. And we feel like, man, I don't know. God's been telling me that he has a plan for my life. I know there's got to be a job out there for me somewhere, but here I am. It's frustrating. It feels like God's just shining me on. But as we read and study the life of David as he relates to Saul, we understand because we've read the whole story, we know he's going to end up being the king of Israel, the greatest king of Israel ever. And yet, there are still some training that he has to go through, and often the training that God has for us isn't pleasant. Sometimes it's heartbreaking. It's just wrenchingly difficult. And yet, when we go through these times, as it was true for David, so it's true for us, he's getting us ready to rule and reign with him. He's getting us ready to fill the role, the calling that he has for our lives. There isn't one tear that you'll ever shed. There isn't one bit of pain that you'll ever experience. There isn't one sleepless night that you'll ever have that isn't a part of what God's ultimately doing in your life. And I know for me, that's comforting. I know for me, that's encouraging. And when I read David's story and I just think, man, David, I wish I could tell you how this is going to turn out. I've read the end of the story, and yet it's much like our lives. It can get kind of tedious. It can get frustrating and difficult, but we know how the story ends. God already told us how it's going to end. He has great plans for our lives. And so as we finish up the toughest part of David's life, we get into 2 Samuel, we're going to see him as he's ascending to the throne, as he's ascending to leadership. But here, these last three chapters are kind of dark and dismal, and yet even in the midst of it, you see shining lights coming through, letting us know David's starting to get it. There are good things that are happening in his life. In chapter 29, we remember back in chapter 28 where we left him, David was getting so desperate, he finally went and signed on with the Philistines. He decided to join the Philistine army. These were his lifelong enemies. They were no great fans of his, of course. He had killed their champion, Goliath, and then made them look stupid when he was a little kid by killing Goliath with a slingshot, cutting his head off, and walking around with it for a while. And so David, they were no fan of David's. And at one time, David had tried to run to the Philistines there in Gath, and King Achish was ready to kill David, and David acted like he was crazy and escaped out of there. But here in chapter 28, we saw that David ends up just defecting to, or chapter 27, that David actually just defected to the Philistines. And Achish saw what a great fighter he was. And he realized by this time how many times Saul had tried to kill David. He thought, maybe this is a safe bet for us. Maybe this will work out okay. And he began to appreciate David's gifts and his abilities. And so he befriended him. And that's a horrible thing. It's always a bad idea for us to go back to the world, for us to decide that it's not happening in the church. It's not happening following the Lord. So I think what I need to do is just compromise a little bit. I'll take my gifts, I'll take my abilities, I'll take my energy, I'll take my money, and I'll stick it somewhere where it's going to do some good. I've heard stories about, oh, if you put money in the offering, God's going to bless you. And I've heard those lies, and I put the money in the offering, and I'm more broke than ever. I'm thinking a crap table sounds pretty good right now. I'm watching those celebrities playing poker, and I'm going, I can beat Ben Affleck. I know it. I know I can. This seems like a good investment for the Lord. Or you're tired of the Christian single scene, and you're realizing, man, I could go to a secular club, and I'll meet somebody. Christians seem to be intimidated by me, turned off by me, or whatever. I'm spiritual, but maybe I'm not as spiritual as they are. And so maybe what I can do is I'll go to the GTO, get the training on how to witness for a few weeks. Then I'll go hit the clubs. I find somebody that just seems like they're maybe a potential match for me. Start dating them, do a little missionary dating, a little sharing, a little kissing, a little dancing. And who knows, I can make my own person that God has prepared for me. Sometimes it sounds tempting. Sometimes you get burned out with trying to do things right and you just go, you know what? It's time for me to just do something wrong. I had a friend who had really had a struggle with drugs and all sorts of things in his life. But man, he committed his life to the Lord and all of that changed. And he was doing good. And he got engaged and was really encouraged. He was at church all the time. Every night he was in church. He was doing good. But the relationship wasn't going so well. And there was a breakup and became really depressed. And he was struggling. And he had one bad night. And he just took off and he went to a motel down on Harbor Boulevard there in Costa Mesa. And he went and scored some heroin out on the street. He'd used heroin for 20 years. Hadn't had it in 3 years at least. But he just thought, you know, one night, I think I just need to go get high and things will be better. Well, unfortunately, he took the dose of heroin that he used to take to get him high. And having been off heroin for 3 years, he couldn't handle it. And it killed him. And he died there in a motel room on Harbor Boulevard. And when I heard that that had happened, through the police, because I was a Costa Mesa police chaplain, and they said, hey, he has Calvary Chapel bulletin and a Bible with him, and when I knew who it was, I was just heartbroken. But I realized so often, maybe not in that way, maybe you don't have anything that weird to go back to, but in so many ways, we're just tempted sometimes to defect. Maybe just for a little bit. Maybe just this one night won't hurt. Maybe just this one excursion won't make a difference. I'm just burned out. I'm tired. And sometimes when we're lonely, when we're hungry, when there's something that's not happening in our lives as we want, we're tempted to turn to something that we know God doesn't want for us. The Bible talks about a dog returning to its vomit, and sometimes that's just what we do. And so that's what David's doing. He's defecting to the enemy. And yet, finally, for once, he feels like he's at home. Achish sets him up with a little city there, Ziklag, and he's got his family there. And finally, Saul's not trying to kill him. It finally feels like, hey, the attack has gone away. And sometimes it works that way for us, you know? When you're walking tight with God, you're under attack constantly. If you just slack off and compromise and stop, you might find, man, life's easier. I know people who don't want to serve God because they say, oh, you know, if you serve God, you're going to have a bunch of attacks. So just stay lukewarm. And Jesus tells us in Revelation chapter 3, if you stay lukewarm, you make me sick. I'll spit you out of my mouth. That's not the way to live. Yes, walking with God means you're under attack. Being anointed, being a future king and priest of God, being in that kind of a situation, yeah, you're going to get attacked. But to let go of what means more than anything to you in the world, being close to God, to let go of the very thing that Jesus died so that you could have it, is not the solution. If you're not under attack, that's not a good thing. If you're under attack, it means Satan's trying to keep something really good from happening in your life. And so it was with David. Things were getting easier. But here in chapter 29, he gets rejected even by the Philistines. And that always hurts. You know, you decide you're going to go backslide, and they don't want you either. You know, it's like, I don't fit with Christians. I don't fit with heathens either. I have too much of God in me to really fit in with the heathens. But I have a little too much of that heathen in me to really fit in with God's people. But things were going well, but they were ready to go to battle. And this is where it gets about the lowest, because the Philistines were now going to go and assault Israel. A full-on destructive path toward Saul himself and his family. And so the Jewish armies were gathering, the Philistine armies were also gathering, and David's ready to go. And the King Saul, who he had spared his life numerous times when he had opportunities, now he's with a bunch of guys that are going to go try to kill him. His best friend Jonathan, this poor kid, his dad Saul, he's messed up. Jonathan's tried to help David at different times, even at risk of his own life, but here he is. He's working for Dad. It's not going well. And David's going to go attack his best friend. And it doesn't seem to even be bothering him. He can't wait to be a part of a winning team. He can't wait to finally cause what God has promised that's going to happen. He can't wait to take it, to do it. Because he knows, hey, the Philistines are going to appreciate him if he fights fiercely. Maybe they'll let him be the king of Israel. Maybe this is how God's going to fulfill his promises to me. And so the armies line up in chapter 29. And they all lined up, and it says in verse 2, the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands. They all lined up, and David and his men were at the rear with Achish. They were way in the back. And the princes of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? What are these Jews doing in our army? And Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? Hey, I've known him for a long time. And to this day I've found no fault in him since he defected to me. But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him. And so they got together and they said, look, send this guy home so that he can go back to the place where you've appointed for him. If you want him in your area, you can have him. But we don't want him. We're not going to battle with him, lest in the battle he become our adversary. He's going, he could turn on us. And Achish is going, why would he do that? Well, they gave a pretty good reason why he might. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, that is Saul, if not with the heads of these men? They're going, hey, we'll get in the middle of the battle, and he's going to go, Saul, I'm on your side. They're thinking he's a double agent or a spy. And he's wanting to kiss up to Saul. So they're going, what better way to do it than for him to be, when we get close to Israel, he starts hacking us to pieces. I mean, yeah, he's only got 600 guys, but he can do a lot of damage in the middle of our army. And they said, don't you remember, man, this is the guy of whom they sang to one another in dances and saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. They're going, this guy's a war hero in Israel. Achish, what are you thinking? And Achish called David and said to him, surely as the Lord lives, you've been upright. And you're going out and you're coming in with me and the army is good in my sight. For to this day I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord does not favor you. Now this is kind of funny. He's getting praise from a Philistine ruler, from Achish. But it lets you know, if you go back and read, while David's been living with the Philistines, he's been living the life of a crook. He's been going out and robbing people. He's been going and looting different areas of Israel. He's living like a common thief, and yet to a Philistine, he looks pretty good. To somebody who doesn't know the Lord and isn't aware, hey, you look great. Be careful when you start judging yourself based on what the Philistines think about you rather than based on what God thinks of you, because it's a whole different world, It's a whole different standard. It's not enough to just be the most righteous guy in your worldly circles. It's not enough that you know, your family thinks you're some kind of religious weirdo. If you're really not totally committed to the Lord and walking with Him and serving Him, the only one we have to answer to is God. And if we listen to the praise of the world, it'll just fool us. It'll be misleading. And Achish was stupid to think that David was so great. David had been doing horrible things, you know, not only to the children of Israel, but to the other people that are around. But so he goes, but, you know, go now, go in peace. I don't want to get these guys mad. He's going, as far as I'm concerned, I'd go to war with you anytime. But these other guys, you know, they aren't going for it. So David said, but what have I done? And to this day, what have you found in your servant as long as I have been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? And Achish said to David, I know you're as good in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said he shall not go with us into battle, so you're not going. Get up, take whoever you want with you, and go back home. Relax. Why don't you sit this one out, David? And we're still cool. We're still fine. I want you as a part of my army, but right now, attacking Israelis with a bunch of Philistines, I don't think you'll fit. God has ways of protecting us from doing things that would destroy us, that we would regret for the rest of our lives. God is so good in going ahead of us. And sometimes, have you ever had this experience when you just feel like sinning? You just feel like backsliding, and you try, and something happens and it doesn't work out? I wonder how many Christians go home from a bar lonely at the end of the night, feeling like, man, I'm so ugly. I can't even get somebody at 2 a.m. when they're drunk and it's dark. And feeling like, oh, what a bummer, when it was God that was causing them to look like a freak to the people in the bar, because he didn't want them to do something that was going to hurt them and destroy them. Watch out for those things. Watch out for those business opportunities that go bad. Watch out for those jobs that you lose. Watch out for those separations of relationship. God is so good that he goes ahead of you. And very often, it feels like he cuts you off at the knees. You feel so rejected. And God's saying, don't you realize what I'm delivering you from? Don't you realize what I'm protecting you with? And often he'll do that. We see God's faithfulness to David, even when David is trying to be a Philistine, and God won't even let him be a good Philistine. And that's a good thing. But David here is just devastated, you can imagine. This was my last hope. Sure, I'd rather be with the Jews, but they don't want me. They're trying to kill me. I've lost everything that matters to me back in Israel, and so I just need to make myself alive. And the Philistines appreciate me. And all of a sudden, here's the guy that he would have died for saying, you know what, I like you, but my friends aren't into you, so why don't you just sit this one out? And he's going, what? I've been so loyal to you. Why don't you go tell your friends, you know, that you'll stick right with me? Why don't you tell them I can be trusted? Well, I tried. Yeah, but that's it? I've been serving you for this long and you won't stick up for me? There are a lot of times when we feel that way. Being rejected by the world, it's really bad. You may feel like you've been rejected by Christians. And then there you are in the world, and the world's rejecting you. And the world always will reject you unless it kills you. Ultimately, as a Christian, God won't let you be happy in the world. There's only so far he'll let you go, and then he's going to go, oh, no, you don't. And so when you're a Christian and you're backslidden, it's kind of bad, because not only are you not pleasing God, but you're not really even enjoying the sin. You're like doing things that you don't even like anymore. And going, why did I ever think this was fun? Why did I ever think this was some kind of fulfilling thing worth living for? It's not. But the rejection that he felt, and so in chapter 30 it says, when David and his men came to Ziklag, 3 days away, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire and had taken captive the women and those who were there from small to great. They didn't kill anybody, they just took them. David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire, and their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive. And David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. David's two wives had been taken captive. Now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. Now David just hits rock bottom. His friend, King Achish, won't defend him, leaves him just out hanging on his own, and then comes back and he finds out, man, my life at home is destroyed as well. We talked about this passage on Sunday morning, so if you weren't here, you could get the tape if you want to go into it in detail. But the main points that I tried to drive home was that when you've misplaced your loyalty, when you've trusted someone who let you down, and then you go back home and you find out this has cost me a lot. Here, I've lost everything. That's how David felt. Like someone who devotes their whole life to something at the expense of their family. And then they go home and find out, you know what? What I put my loyalty in wasn't worth it. And at the same time, it's cost me those things most dear to me. I thought I was working for my family. And it turns out the work I was doing was stupid. I climbed to the top and found out the ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. And then my family, well, they've had it. It's too late for them. It won't work. One definition of failure that I've seen is being successful at something that doesn't matter. That's failure. Setting all of your attention toward doing something that turns out not to be worth doing. And yet there's nothing quite like that disappointment that comes when you've poured yourself out for a cause that turns out to be not worth it. You know, when you've expended yourself so much, you'd do anything for these people. And then you're rejected by them. And then you find out you've lost so much, you've lost everything. And then your friends aren't even there for you. They're trying to stone you, as David's friends were. But when that happens, it opens the door for God to do something great in our lives. And David did the right thing. David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And we read on Sunday how he inquired of the Lord and God promised him, hey, I've got this under control. You're going to go and you're going to get everything back. I'll be with you. It's going to be okay. But the thing that I stressed at the end of the study Sunday was the fact that he had to do it himself. There was no Jonathan to strengthen his hand in the Lord this time. It's just him and God. And sometimes God will leave you with just you and him so that you'll realize that ultimately your strength is in him. It's not in someone else. Often we feel like if only there were people who cared about me, if only I could have a circle of, you know, sometimes we get jealous because there are certain people that seem like they're so loved. They're just surrounded by people who value them. And then we may be sitting there just going, you know what? I don't even have any really close friends. No one ever asked me to do anything. If somebody said, hey, why don't you go call one of your friends? I wouldn't know who to call. Oh, I have acquaintances, but there's no one I'm close to. And we look at someone who has close relationships and we're jealous. We wonder, what is it about me? What is it about them? What's the deal? How do you have those kinds of friendships? But you know what? More important than that is the friend who sticks closer than a brother. You know, if you don't have any friends, I'm sure there are reasons. And you ask around a little bit, you might figure it out. The Bible says if you want friends, be friendly. But if you're just always bringing everyone down and everything, it's no big mystery why you don't have a lot of friends. It's if you're obnoxious or you don't listen, all you do is talk. I should talk. Here I am. I'm just talking to you. If that's the way you live your life, yeah, you're probably not going to have any friends. But you know what? Even if you're an obnoxious jerk, but you know Jesus Christ, you have the only friend that matters. It'd be good for you to learn to shut your mouth, maybe. It'd be good for you to get out of yourself and to be a little more positive. All those things would really enrich your life. But more than all of a sudden being surrounded by friends, that's a life skill that you just have to learn. But more than that, to be able to know that wherever I am, I can go to God and allow Him to give me the strength. And as I shared Sunday, I know that God, and I had a lot of people afterwards say, oh, that was just for me. So I knew that God was having me do it, and I didn't like to do it. I don't want to sound harsh or uncaring or unfeeling. I don't want to make excuses and act like, you know, I'm telling you this because I don't want to have the burden of feeling like I need to babysit you. But what I said Sunday ultimately was, sometimes the word from God is suck it up and get up and strengthen yourself in the Lord. Don't wait for someone else to do it. Now, that doesn't excuse me from reaching out to you. And you know this. I'm not saying this because I'm trying to get less counseling appointments. Any of you, you want to get a hold of me, you can get a hold of me if you'll wait long enough, if you'll call enough. I want to be available to you. But there are so many times when I feel like you're asking for something that I don't have. You really need to grow up. Not that I would always want to be there for any of you, but at the same time, unless you learn to strengthen yourself in the Lord, it's not happening. Jonathan might be there one time, and you depend on Jonathan. The next time, he's not there. No one understands. No one knows what you're going through, and so there you are. What do? You strengthen yourself in your God, your personal God, the one that you know. I won't preach my Sunday message again. I'll move on. But I did, you know, there was one thing that I didn't say it Sunday. I thought about sharing this, but I decided it would run the risk of offending some people or hurting someone. If somebody's already hurting, I don't want to add hurt to them. But a Wednesday night crowd, I know you guys can take it. It was just, I heard Raul Reese one time talking to his congregation, and he said, you guys come here and you call up and you come down here and you want counseling. He said, you don't need counseling, you need diapers. And I'm just quoting Raul, I wouldn't say it. But I'll tell you something, it convicts me that sometimes how I can get down or depressed and discouraged and feeling attacked, and I'm whining around to God, I'm struggling, I'm dragging myself around, and I think that that would be the word of God for me sometime. Suck it up. Don't be a baby. Why don't you be a man? Just do what you need to do with me. Spend time with me. Pray to me. Listen to me. Even if you don't feel like it. And I've had many times when I go off to talk with the Lord, and one of the first things He does after He listens to my whining, He'll just kind of kick me in the butt a little bit. And then I start to get it. I go, wow, God, it really does work with the two of us. You don't need to reach me in some other way. You don't need to fix my predicament that I'm in. You don't even need to give me any more information. You need to teach me. All I need is to know that you're the source of my strength, that all I need is you. And sometimes, I'm warning you, you won't know that God is all you need until God is all you have. And sometimes God starts taking things away from us so that we will learn to strengthen ourselves in Him. It's better if you put everything else aside and strengthen yourself in the Lord before He guts your house, you know, before He takes your job, before He does everything else to you. But wherever you find yourself, for all of us, it's key that we learn to strengthen ourselves in the Lord. As I mentioned Sunday, I said I wasn't going to preach Sunday's message. I don't know, I got in this groove, sorry. But in Galatians, where Paul says, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. And a few verses later, he says, each man must bear his own burden. The reason? Yeah, we're supposed to reach out to each other. It's a shame when we don't. But sometimes no one's going to do that for you. And you better learn to take care of yourself spiritually and drag yourself into the presence of God. Don't make someone else push in there. So anyhow, David does this. He gets the promise. As they're going in verse 11, I was worried I wouldn't have enough to share tonight. As they go to verse 11, they're heading off trying to find these armies of Amalekites. And remember, the Amalekites who took their families and burned their city, these are the guys that should have been destroyed years before. They're the primary reason why God turned His back on Saul, because He didn't destroy the Amalekites, and then He lied about it to Samuel. Well, it comes back to haunt him big time, and this is an example of it. The Amalekites were a problem from then on. So they found this Egyptian guy. He was a slave of the Amalekites. He had been involved in the raid of all the cities that they had been attacking, the Amalekites. Well, they knew the Philistines were busy going after the Jews. The Jews were busy defending themselves against the Philistines. So it takes an Amalekite to figure a way to cash in. But they had this Egyptian slave, and the guy had just conked out. He couldn't go any further. So you're not going to waste too much energy carrying a slave. There are more where that came from, and they just dumped him off. And by the way, before that happened, 200 of David's guys were so tired after all this that they dragged, and so he left them back at the brook with, their job was to take care of the stuff, the luggage and everything, the supplies. So now here's an Egyptian who's worn out, and he came and they fed him and gave him some water. He hadn't had any for 3 days, and gave him a cake of figs, a little fig Newton, and some raisins. And when he had eaten, verse 12, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. And David said, "Who owns you? Where are you from?" He said, "Well, I'm from Egypt, but I work for an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I got sick, couldn't go any further. So we've been evading all these lands." And David said, and one of the places, he said, "And we burned Ziklag with fire." And so David said, "Can you take me down to this troop?" So he said, "Swear to me by God that you'll neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I'll take you down to this troop." He's going, "Yeah, I'll show you where they are, but don't turn me over to my boss. He's going to be really mad that I brought you here. And don't kill me, or you can just kill me here. No point in taking you for no reason." And so David said, "Sure." And they brought him down and saw where these guys, the Amalekites, were hiding, all spread out all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. I mean, they didn't have to kill anybody even. All the guys were gone off at war, so they just came and took whatever they wanted. So here they're celebrating and drunk and partying. And David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. These guys were tired already, but they got pumped when they saw these guys are sitting ducks. There's nothing like, I don't know, this probably sounds bad, but there's nothing like fighting a drunk, because they think they can conquer the world, but it's so easy to dominate them. When you're out with the police and some drunk's causing problems, almost anyone could take control of most drunks. There are some exceptions. But these guys, as warriors, their weapons were down, their guards down. Here they are, they're drunk out of their minds, passing out all over the place. And so David and his guys, 400 guys, just came in and just wiped them out. And it says that David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. Aww. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Even the stuff they didn't want, the junk that they took, the stuff that, you know, they were kind of hoping to get an insurance claim on. Sorry, it's all there. They got everything. Plus, they got all kinds of other stuff that belonged to other people. So David was excited, and he took all the flocks and herds that they had driven before all the other livestock, and he goes, "I'll take the cattle. I'm in the mood for a steak," David says. So David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they would not follow David. They were back at the brook Bezor. They made him stay at the brook. And so they went out to meet David. They were excited to see David coming back. Imagine being 200 guys that are too tired to ford this brook. And so you're left there guarding this stuff. You don't know what's going on. You figured, probably our families are dead. Most likely, David and our buddies are going to get killed by the Amalekites. And then the Amalekites are going to come hunting us down. And we're dead too. And so they see David coming back with all of his soldiers. No one's missing. And they're excited. And so, you know, they came out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him, slapping everyone five, and kind of like the parties at the airport when after the Lakers end up winning the fourth playoff game here in the finals. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. He was like, "Man, it's good to see you guys." They might have been wondering how David was going to treat them. You know, we feel like quitters. I feel like we wimped out. And, you know, boy, you almost hate to congratulate him. But David was really kind to them. But all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David chimed in and said, hey, because they didn't go with us, we're not going to give them any of the spoil that we've recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. These creeps are going, you guys wimped out on us. Now you don't get anything. Well, you can have your wives and kids, but you're not even going to get your stuff back. Because we were out there risking our lives. And you were sitting back here kicking back at the brook. This isn't right. You're not getting anything. But David said, my brothers. It's kind of nice that these worthless jerks, David still, when he talks to them, he calls them brothers. He still reaches out to them. He's not all mad at them. He's not trying to destroy them. He says, my brothers, you're not going to do that with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who's going to listen to you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. So it was from that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. And then when he got back to Ziklag, he started sending all the extra stuff out to all these different areas. You can see that for the rest of the chapter. David's like, man, we've been blessed. Here you go. And he starts sending supplies to some of these cities that had been devastated, some of the Jewish cities and other cities that were around that needed help. He gave to them. Now, this was the passage of scripture that I was going to speak on last Sunday until the Lord told me that somebody needed to be beat up, so I changed to the other one. But the Lord beat me up, actually, and that's why. But we get some insight into David and his maturity at this point. He's this renegade guy who's kind of being selfish, and yet at the same time, he has a heart for God. And now it would be so easy to begin to exclude those who don't measure up. And yet God's program is never a program of exclusion. It's not, what we need to do is get rid of some people who don't belong here. They should be out of here. They should be gone. A lot of times I get concerned about the body of Christ when we become so focused on kicking people out. And I've said this before, but it amazes me. 24 years that I was on staff at Calvary Costa Mesa, we probably kicked two or three people out of the church because they were a legitimate danger to someone. There were people who would come up and take issue with Chuck, argue with him, question him. He knew they weren't supportive of him. Never kicked him out of the church. And you see, sometimes little tiny churches, they're kicking people out all the time. I don't know, maybe that's why they're little tiny churches, but we can so often get this mentality that says, if somebody disagrees with me, they're out. If somebody's not pulling their weight, they're gone. You know, I could get up there on Sunday and go, you know what? And I could say this to you because this is Wednesday, but I could go, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's only the people that attend Wednesday night that are really spiritual. It's true. But if I said that, what's it going to... No, not really. I'm kidding. But what's it going to accomplish? But these guys were just going, we need to trim ourselves down to a lean, mean fighting machine. It's survival of the fittest. Let's get rid of the weaklings and the troublemakers. Oh, they got mad and left the church? Good. Good riddance. You know, they're dead wood anyway. But David's attitude is so much different than that. He was just, you know what? I'm going to treat everyone the same. We're all in this together. And he established this policy that says, hey, when this happens, the people that stay back and watch the stuff, they're going to get an equal share with the ones who win the victory. It's the rule David set up, and that's the way it was. And what I was going to share with you on Sunday morning was that when God blesses us, what do we do with it? David could have easily kept all this stuff, and it would have been a good start to a government. He was about to become king. And yet, what he had, he realized, I didn't get this. I love where he says in verse 23, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hands the troop that came against us. We're all blessed in a lot of ways. But what do we do with those things that God blesses us with? Do we realize and understand that this is from God? That it's stuff that he has given us, and when he gives us things, it's to disperse them When he gives us things, it's so that we're able to share. Now, I think one reason why God didn't have me teach this passage on Sunday morning and had me instead do it on Wednesday night is because it's easy to spin off from this and give a big plea for an offering. And you know I'd never do that. But I'm glad Wednesday nights we don't even take an offering. So even if you feel convicted, you're not going to give it. But also, I'm not talking about paying your tithe. I'm not talking about giving your money to the church. Oh, if God lays that on your heart to do it, by all means do it. But what I'm talking about is taking everything that you have and just going, how can I use this for others? How can I reach out to help others? How can I share? It might just mean opening up your home to someone who's from out of town and just needs a place to stay for a couple days. It might mean blessing somebody with some money, even if you don't get a tax write-off for it. It might mean, and frankly, and you won't hear many pastors say this, but if you know someone who has a great need and you're thinking about putting your money in the offering plate, and God tells you, why don't you give it to this person instead? You know what? I'm not going to be bugged at you at all. And not only that, God's pleased. He just wants us to give. The point isn't for him to get a bunch. The point is for us to realize everything we have comes from God. Everything we have came from him, and to share that. And if that happens, more people get blessed as a result of what God's doing. And so David had that heart. He even made it a rule. And then he just took. He was blessed and he gave it out. What a contrast between David and Nabal after, remember, a few chapters ago when he had his harvest and he wouldn't even give a little bit of food to David and his guys. How about us when there's a windfall? We get a bonus or some money comes in unexpectedly or we just realize, you know, there's a few extra bucks right now. Is our thought, what do I buy? Is our consideration, hey, you know, that would make a pretty good down payment on a jet ski. And then God will probably provide the other money to make the payments. Or, you know, that TV, that 36-inch TV, it's looking pretty wimpy. And those plasma TVs are looking pretty good. And praise God, he's provided some extra money right now. We have it in the bank. It's no, I don't want to lay a guilt trip on you if you bought a plasma TV. Those things, by the way, start losing pixels after about 2 years, those $7,000 TVs. But be that as it may, how about looking at what we have and saying, God, what do you want me to do with your money? How do you want me to use your stuff? If I was to suggest, and this happens, you see it happen in churches where people take the church's money, take the Lord's money, and they spend it on foolish things. They spend it extravagantly. We've seen that happen too much. It happens. And sometimes we just think, oh, how awful that that pastor would take God's money and spend it on those toys. But the question that you need to ask yourself, what are you doing with God's money? What am I doing with God's money? I wouldn't think of taking a handful of money out of the offering plate and going and blowing it. But everything we have is offering plate. It's God's. The question isn't how much money do I need to give to God. That's between you and God. And you know, I don't teach that you should have some legalistic sort of, I owe God 10% and should tip him on top of that. I'm not into that at all. But what I am into is realizing how much of God's money do I dare spend on myself? Now, he has given us everything to enjoy. Don't go away feeling guilty because your car runs. Don't go away feeling bad because you have a nice house or something. God can make money come out of nowhere. He paves the streets with gold in heaven. And so he does want us to do some fun things with our money. He does want us to feel blessed. It's biblically, that's always been the case. And yet at the same time, and I think sometimes if you're, right now, if you're feeling guilty about money that you're spending, it might just be because you don't realize God wants to bless you. That's okay. But at the same time, to look at what you have and say, I got this from God. This was his. It's still his. I've given it to him. I wonder what he wants me to do with it. And he may want you to buy a plasma TV. You know, if so, hey, I'll be over at your house for the Super Bowl. But he also may want you to do something else really crazy with it. Like give it to somebody. Out of the blue, somebody that God just lays on your heart. I remember one time, a gal I knew, single mom, really struggling, but she never told anybody about her needs. And someone came along and just felt led to buy her a car. Now, a lot of times we get old cars donated to the church and we're glad to have them. We use them, our missionaries use them, we give them to people who need transportation. But this is the first time ever that somebody came to me and said, I want to buy a brand new car for somebody. That was amazing. And they did. And you know, for her to see that gift coming from God, having no clue as to who paid for it, just knowing that was a gift from God, I guarantee you, you know, it wasn't a Rolls Royce, it was a Toyota or something, but that was probably, for that person, maybe the best $10,000, $12,000 they had ever spent as far as what God was going to do in being blessed by what they did for someone else. And so, when we've been blessed, when we have extra, or even when it doesn't look like extra, to just look, how can I bless others? How can I use what God has given me? And to always remember, this was God's. He gave it to me. I didn't earn it. The other thing that I want to emphasize here, and I will finish tonight, and I'll do it as close on time as I can. The other thing I want to remind you of is the guys who stayed back and watched the stuff got equal rewards with the ones who went and fought the battle. Now, we hear of people who are called off. You know, you hear of Eric who gets to go to Japan. We have a list of missionaries and people who are out there serving God. Sometimes we're jealous. We go, man, I wish I could do that. But I can't right now. I can't get the time off. I can't really afford it. Or nobody's giving me this opportunity. Love to go to Mexico, can't speak Spanish. And yet, our part, sitting back here at home, is to hold them up in prayer, is to be able to contribute, to help them to be able to do what they do. And there's no one who could go serve God out on the front lines unless there are people back here who are praying for them, who are supporting them, who are loving them, encouraging them. And the blessed thing is when one of our people is off there serving God, when you hear that, you know, Gene and Julie are over there in Cambodia ministering to these little orphans, and God's just working and exciting things are happening, and there's something inside of you that feels like, I wish I could do that. But Cambodia, I don't think so. You can do it. You can be with them anytime you want as you hold them up before the throne of God in prayer, as you type a little email to them and let them know that you love them and you're praying for them, as you send 10 bucks to them. You know what 10 bucks can do in Cambodia? It's amazing. But I love the fact that those of us who are landlocked, who are stuck back here, as we see others going out, and we go, wow, look at those guys. You know, the Nakashimas are on their way to Hawaii in this next week. And you go, wow, that'd be cool. To know that God's just completely moving you to a different place. Why can't I do that? You can. Pray for them. Support them. Let them know that you're behind them. And you know, the great thing is, every bit of reward that God has for those people who are, quote, on the front lines, it's shared with us. We're a part of it completely. It is not a higher calling of God to go to the mission field than it is to support the missionaries, to pray for them. It's the same thing, because it takes all kinds. If there weren't people to stay back here and support, they wouldn't be out there on the front lines. If David's 200 guys that were tired didn't stay back there with the supplies, how would they have been able to do what they needed to do? And so I want to encourage you. If you're back by the brook, you know what? God has a policy that says, you win. You will be rewarded. God will bless you for being supportive in whatever way he leads you to do that. Chapter 31. The Philistines finally came down there. They went up, and the Israelis were on Mount Gilboa, which is up in the, well, it's a little bit to the east of the Jordan River, south of Galilee, kind of in the northern part of Israel, not too far from the Jordan River. The Philistines had been mustering down in the northern part of their territory, which is down by kind of on the coast of the Mediterranean, which would be almost even with the Dead Sea down there. So they moved up, chased the Israelis up to Mount Gilboa, which is up near the end of the Jewish territory, and Philistines followed hard after Saul. They killed Jonathan, his other two brothers. The battle became fierce. They were going for Saul, and his guys were defending him, but an arrow hit him. He was severely wounded, and Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword out and kill me, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me." They would often do humiliating things to kings when they would catch them, torture them. The armor bearer wouldn't kill him because he was greatly afraid. Therefore, Saul took a sword and fell on it. Now, and then it says, when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. He was disgraced that the one he was supposed to protect was now dead. Later on, well, in the first chapter of 2 Samuel, there's this Amalekite who claims that he was the one who killed Saul, and it might be, we don't know if he was telling the truth or not, it's probably true. His story was that he came upon Saul, Saul begged him to put him out of his misery, and he actually did. If that's the case, Saul fell on his sword, didn't die immediately, and this Amalekite came and finished him off. But anyway, he was dead. Saul, the three sons, armor bearer, they all died that day. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those who were on the other side of the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they left the cities and fled. So all of the people up in that northern part of Israel, even on the east side of the Jordan River, they just go, man, it's all over for us. We're dead. And so this battle happened, by the way, in the valley of Megiddo there. And as it happened, the Jews were wiped out completely. And it happened the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain. They found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head, stripped off his armor, and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim it in the temple of their idols and among the gods. They put his armor up in the temple of the Ashtoreths, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. Now his sword and his crown, the Amalekite had already taken, and so it wasn't there. So they just hung him up and were making fun of him. And when the Jews who were in Jabesh-Gilead, which is over on the east side of the Jordan River, when they heard what happened, they came. A bunch of valiant men came at night, got Saul's body, the body of his sons, took them off the wall where they were hanging, brought them back to Jabesh, and they cremated them, and took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. A sad ending to a life that could have been. Saul had so much going for him. Remember in the beginning when we read that the Spirit of God came upon him? And when the Spirit of God came upon him, he was a different person? God could have used him, but his rebellion, his disobedience, his egotism, the pride, he began to think that it was about him, that he was somebody, disqualified him. And he dies a tragic death along with, we don't know much about his other two sons, but we know what Jonathan was like. And now he's gone too. Rebelling against God, thinking that you are above what God has to say, believing you don't need to obey what he says, it'll not only kill you, but it's going to damage your family. It's going to hurt all the people who support you as well. So a sad ending to a life, but at the same time, God's doing some things in David's life. And we're going to see that as we get into 2 Samuel, just the excitement of seeing a man who God really gets a hold of him. And he's just serving simply, and his heart's been broken, but his heart's also committed to serving God. He's not perfect. He makes mistakes. They're well documented. But at the same time, he is the one who the Bible says, he's a man after my heart. I relate to him, God says. And when we read the Psalms and we see how David expresses himself, we understand. And we get to witness it. And so next week, we'll plunge into David's continuing story in 2 Samuel and see all that God's going to do. Let's all stand. Lord, we thank you for so diligently recording these stories that have so much to say to us. Oh, we haven't scratched the surface of all that you want to speak to us. But Lord, hopefully you've kind of prodded enough in our hearts that each of us has something to chew on for the rest of this week. Continue to speak to us, Lord. Continue to allow us to sense your voice, your spirit, as you're working in us what you want to do. And God, help us to not have to turn to the Philistines and experience the disappointment of what that does. Help us not to have to turn on our own people to learn the lessons that you have for us. But help us to learn from the stories that you've given us in your word, from the things that happened to Saul and to David and to others, so that we'll learn from their mistakes. We'll also learn from their successes. Be with us, God. In Jesus' name, amen.